We're going to call this meeting to order. This is the education sub of Ways and Means, and it is the 25th. Is that right?
Yeah.
I got my date right. Okay, it is the 25th, and it is Wednesday. And
can I have a, I just ask a simple question?
Senator Thompson.
And this might be too simple, because I'm new to this budget, so. We spent a month listening to the education K through 12 budget, and we're not going to fund hardly any of those proposals that we saw.
Yet.
How much time are we going to spend on higher education and not fund?
We have about 2.5 more weeks on PEC, is that right?
Just making a point.
About 2.5 more weeks.
Thank you.
And yes,
I feel better.
And yes, we are going to fund many of the things that we talked about in early childhood and things like that. We just have to figure out the priority list. And co-chair Comp and I have been meeting with folks from the governor's office and others, trying to get an idea what's most critical and so on. So we're just starting our work. And Senator Roebland, did you run into the translator down there?
Yeah, he did tell me that it was something to do with ancient China, because it's, okay. It's an old language. It's the an older Mandarin that he knows easily. But he was intent on translating and trying to figure it all out. So.
Let me get the meeting started.
Mr. Cannon. Doug, anything to say before we turn it back over to Ben?
Mr. Chair, just a note from yesterday. There was at least one article in a paper saying that the additional $20 million in the state school fund had come out of the $60 million pot. I sent you an email this morning, all of you, that it is my understanding, after asking the co-chairs and verifying it with them, that it did not come out of the $60 million.
It's certainly my understanding as well. If I had thought it came out of the 60, I would probably have been a no.
And your co-chair agrees.
Yes. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Senator Monroe, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And we'll pick up where we left off yesterday, which is slightly behind the agenda, but we did lose a little bit of time to some of your lingering K-12 work this week. I think over the next day and a half, really today and tomorrow, we'll get back on schedule and be in good shape for next week. So yesterday, we sort of concluded by presenting a few slides that really cover the entirety of our budget, sort of budget slides. And I describe those in the context of the HEX emphasis on increasing funding for higher education and focusing funding related to higher education. What I want to do at the outset today is provide some context and some history to help support the notion that higher education funding in Oregon ought to be increased. And this will, you've heard the general story, but hopefully some of the slides and data here will be new and helpful to you. So let's start with community colleges, and this is a historical look. So state appropriations and FT, I forgot, these are animated. Oh good, I get to walk through these. Okay, so community college funding has not kept pace with inflation or enrollment. So let's start with, this is non-inflation adjusted state appropriations to community colleges. So this is on your screen. Reflects non-inflation adjusted appropriations since 1999. You'll note the little gray bars at the bottom are debt service. And one way that we're approaching this that may be somewhat different than how you've looked at these kinds of figures in the past is we're including state supported debt or state paid debt service in the total state appropriation for colleges and universities. So this is non-inflation adjusted. Now, nifty, inflation adjusted. So you start to see the downward trend. And to Senator Monroe's point here, these numbers we've started from zero. So this could look like a starker trend if we just, you know, chopped or began the y-axis up at 400 million. Nevertheless, you see the sort of downward trend over time, although an increase in the last biennium and then proposed for the governor's budget for the upcoming one. And finally, set that against a pretty significant enrollment increase. Now, that too is declining. Enrollment is declining as the economy improves and people go back to work. Nevertheless, the story here, I hope, is pretty clear that state funding for community colleges is down, especially in inflation-adjusted terms when compared to 1999, and enrollment went way up and now is returning to sort of pre-recession levels. Let's look at universities. Same story, although even starker. So first, non-inflation-adjusted, and again, only a slight, if you set aside the 15-17 bar, the last bar there, only a slight increase in non-inflation-adjusted state appropriations back to 1999. So that's 15 years, and our state investment has barely budged. I want to particularly highlight the debt service here. Again, we are increasing, and if we were to just focus in on that, we're spending significantly more as a state to service bonds that we've approved for university-related capital. When we put this in inflation-adjusted terms, you can see we're well below the historical points back to 1999, and enrollment on the university side also has increased. This focuses only on resident students, so the enrollment number here does not include the actually quite a bit more significant growth in non-resident students. We're only focused here and in the slides upcoming on resident students. So how does this look in per student terms? Two lines here. The top one is for universities. The bottom one for community colleges. This is non-inflation adjusted. So again, we're often what I find particularly striking here. We're accustomed to hearing about ways in which government services, state services, have been underfunded or defunded. We hear that about a lot of things, and it's been true about many. What I find so striking about these non-inflation-adjusted slides is they just present in a very stark way that this is the reality of higher education, the history of higher education funding in Oregon. In even before you account for inflation, we are investing less as a state than we did in 1999 on in per-student terms. The dashed lines at the end indicate where we would go under the co-chair, under the governor's recommended budget. The co-chair's figures for universities and community colleges would add several hundred dollars to the per student funding levels at the university side and over 100 at the community college side. So we'd be sort of in the $6,300 and $3,000 levels. This is pretty striking in terms of a pattern of state disinvestment. And again, I'll stress the non-inflation adjusted. We're looking back 16 years over that time period. Of course, even at only 2-3% inflation, these numbers are pretty stark. How does Oregon compare to the national average? Well, you know this. We're quite low, and under this depiction, and there are several different ways of slicing the data, but this is from WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education. Oregon is the fourth lowest and well below the national average in per student appropriations to public appropriations to higher education. You've had some discussion of this general topic, I think, but the shifting nature of how we fund higher education and education, there's a larger story here going back to Measure 5, but if we focus specifically on higher education, this is public universities. State appropriations at one time were almost half of the sort of education budgets for public universities. It's now down to less than a fifth, 19% in 2013. Tuition and fees have made up the rest. And on the community college side, this data goes back a little farther. We've included this back to 1989. Here you really do see the Measure 5 effect with local revenues that universities, of course, do not enjoy, but community colleges do. But those local revenues declining very significantly in the 90s, state general fund picking up that slack in the initial years, but then being cut back as other state needs pressed, and tuition and fees were sort of allowed to rise in order to try to fill those gaps. And I think it's pretty safe to say that one of the core strategies that the state of Oregon has used to balance its state budget in difficult times has been to allow tuition to increase. Essentially, we've cut state higher education funding, understanding that there was an opportunity, or it was one option that was available to colleges and universities, was to increase tuition to make up those gaps. And is especially stark when we look at the 2008 to 2011 timeframe and the very significant state cuts to higher education that we experienced there, and the very significant tuition increases that colleges and universities imposed. Going back to the national perspective here, this expresses the amount of our public higher education revenue that is derived from tuition by state. And so on the right-hand side, you have states that derive practically all of their higher education revenue from tuition, and on the left-hand side, those that have very little. Pretty astonishing diversity between Wyoming at only 13% of its higher education revenue being tuition, and Vermont at 85%. Oregon is on the upper end, so over 60% of our higher education revenue is tuition-based, making us one of the states in the country that depends most on tuition to support public higher education. And one might be able to make a case for that approach to financing higher education if one had a robust state investment in need-based aid. We do not. Oregon is a low need-based aid state. We'll talk quite a bit later today or tomorrow about the Opportunity Grant, our need-based aid program, and of course we have recommendations for increasing it. But Oregon remains and would remain, even under the increases proposed, well below the national average in per-student funding of need-based aid. So takeaways here, we are a high-tuition, low-need-based aid state. And that's not a great position to be in if you're concerned, as we are, about the affordability of higher education. Final point on the need-based aid side, this is one expression, and we'll see some others, of the gap between the demand for need-based aid, that's the green bar representing eligible students, and our funding of it, that's the brown bar, the number of students who are actually receiving the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick check-in on that, Ben. And that is people who are eligible for it, not necessarily applicants, though, right?
Representative Smith-Warner, Madam Co-Chair, this actually represents applications, and Bob will correct me if I'm wrong, but this represents FAFSAs that the state receives that students who have completed them are, in fact, eligible based on the income criteria. So not every one of these 131,000 students may actually enroll in college in the fall, but all 131,000 of these students have submitted a FAFSA that our office has received that predicts their eligibility for the award. And yeah, Bob is confirmed.
They also indicated their intention to go to an Oregon university program.
You need to come up to the microphone and say your name and give us that important fact.
Apologies. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I'm Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. Yes, so these students have filed the FAFSAs, and not only are they Oregon residents, but they've indicated their intention to go to an Oregon college or university that's eligible for the Opportunity Grant.
Thank you. That's
and
that, very
and
helpful.
All other eligibility requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think that's where I'll leave it in terms of context, history, and our national comparisons around funding adequacy, if you will. But let's talk a little bit more about focusing funding. So this that helps to make the case, I think, for increasing the state's investment in higher education. But alongside that, the commission believes strongly we need to focus those dollars, those resources, in ways that support student success. We'll talk about a few of the proposals that the commission has relative to focusing investment. And the opportunity grant redesign is one of those. But what I want to spend a couple of minutes on today, with the possibility of coming back if invited during phase two for a longer discussion of this, is the commission's ongoing work to change how the dollars that you appropriate for colleges and universities will be distributed to them or allocated to them. The HEC, as I've mentioned before, adopts by rule distribution formulas, so the methodology for allotting or allocating the state dollars to our community colleges and universities. And the commission's strategic plan signals its intent to shift the basis of those state distributions from enrollment partly to successful completion. And we believe this provides both an incentive and a reward and supports for institutions that make intentional investments in student success. That work to develop those new bases for funding distributions is well underway. We're in the rulemaking process now for changing the public university funding formulas, so we're open for public comment. We'll be bringing forward a staff recommendation, we expect, to the commission in April. Would be happy to meet with, we've met with several of you at various points about this work, would be happy to sit down and describe in as much detail as you want our efforts on that. Likewise, with community colleges, we've spent considerable time working with the institutions and other stakeholders on potential new formula design. The commission will not be moving forward at this point with a distribution formula shift for the 2015-16 year, but that work continues to progress, and we anticipate entering a rulemaking process later in this calendar year for potential implementation starting in 2016-17. So we're sort of on a longer time frame for the community college formula changes, but the public university ones are really in process now.
And Ben, as you move towards an outcome-based program and plan, I really do hate to bring up this subject. Are you changing your technology to do your record keeping, or tell us how you're going to get to that outcome numbers?
Madam Co-Chair, it's an important question. Our ability to successfully use outcomes as part of the basis for how we distribute money depends on having robust systems to monitor the outcomes and sort of track the outcomes at a campus level, and they have to be systems that we have confidence in. At this moment in time, we are more confident in our systems and our data from public universities, in part because of the different history of public universities, with the public university system whose data and institutional research office we're inheriting in part. And so we have robust IT systems and data from them that permits the sort of easier inclusion of outcomes in a funding formula. Community colleges, we're working on it. And one of the reasons for delaying the rulemaking to process for a new formula is to become more confident in the data that we have that would be part of the basis for the formula. It should be no surprise, the data that we feel really good about on the community college side is the FTE data, because that's how we fund colleges. And so we audit that. We work very closely with the colleges. We have for years to make sure we're getting very accurate FTE counts from the colleges. Completion data, it's a little more iffy on the community college side, just because we haven't funded it. We've reported on it. We've reported to you and others on completion data, but it's not as robust, and we don't have as high a level of confidence in it, and we need to get to that point before we make any formula shifts.
Thank you.
So why do this? This echoes some of the conversation we had at the outset of our presentation about the completion of certificates and degrees. this data, as we just noted, is challenging and complex, particularly at the community college level, where not all students enroll with the intent of completing a certificate or a degree. But the numbers on this slide come from a national organization, Complete College America, and their analysis of completion data from Oregon colleges and universities. And it should be and is a concern that the majority of students at community colleges do not complete certificates or degrees, and roughly 40% of students who enroll in Oregon public universities don't complete a bachelor's degree within 6 years. And the focus of a funding shift is to provide rewards for and supports for institutions to invest in the types of programs, the guidance, the counseling, the mentoring, the coaching, in significant part, that can improve these numbers. And we know they can because we see that from some of our institutions, both in Oregon as well as other states.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. I love this conversation, Ben, and I think it's a conversation we need to have. I have a concern in it. I do believe, philosophically, we fund community colleges more for marketing, getting butts in seats, than outcomes, certainly. But that said, I'm a community college dropout. I have a degree, but I am a community, technically I'm a community college dropout. So how do you get past that piece of that just being the nature of the beast? I'm not saying we shouldn't try, but it is a challenge.
Representative Springer, Madam Co-Chair, thank you for the question. It's a really good one.
And Mr. Co-Chair has
And Mr. Co-Chair. The part of the way we get at it is by a more expansive view of what student success at a community college means. It isn't just certificates and degrees, and the formulas that our commission has considered for community colleges, the outcomes that our commission has considered funding for community colleges, aren't just certificate degrees. They include transfers to four-year universities, whether or not a certificate or degree has been completed. Okay. They include progress towards certificate or degree, so the completion of certain numbers of credits that represent milestones, even though they're not in and of themselves a certificate or degree. 15 credits, 45 credits would become sort of funding points in a new formula. They include the completion of a developmental education sequence. A lot of our community college students, in fact, a majority of our community college students, begin not yet college ready, at least as determined by the college through placement tests in writing, reading, math. And as a result, they're in developmental education courses, and those would continue to be, though the completion of a developmental education series or sequence would be a potential funding point by the commission. Finally, in both of these proposed formulas, the public university one that we're closer to adopting, as well as the community college one that we've put some delay in, enrollment, just the butt in the seat, would continue to be a significant portion of how the state allocates dollars. We don't propose transitioning these to be 100% outcomes or anything close to it, frankly. But enough outcome funding to create the incentive and the reward and the support for institutions to make those investments in student success.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. Ben, how many, what percentage of students complete a bachelor's degree at the Oregon one of the OUS schools within 4 years?
Representative Taylor, Madam Co-Chair, I'll have to get back with the exact data on that. So our
approximately.
And our 6 year data it ranges in the sort of 50 to 80%, as I recall, depending on the university. And 4 year data, which we have, I'll have to get back to you. It's certainly in our fact book, but I don't have it at our fingertips.
Follow up. So up till about, I'll estimate about 5 years ago, a lot of the data that was coming out of OUS was showing the five-year graduation rates, and there seems to have been this movement, not just with our universities, but across the country, to track everything in the 6 years. And to build on the point that Representative Springer brought up yesterday, I guess this is just a request, but if I think going forward to see, since we are, this is supposed to be a four-year model in theory, just so that we can get a sense of how many students are finishing in 4 years, and then maybe 5 years and 6 years, but there seems to be this data reporting at the six-year mark, and it's just trying to get an understanding because it is contributing so much to the cost and the debt. I guess that's just a request I have to better understand it.
Thank you. Be happy to do that.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
So just a couple of concluding thoughts on the outcomes funding shift, and we can, again, come back to this at another point in your work if you'd like. You know, incentivizing campus level innovation, so we're not dictating how to improve these outcomes, but creating incentives and supports to do so, intentionally focusing the state dollars on student success, and trying to, as a result, move these numbers that we showed yesterday relative to return on investment. So a few questions that we're considering, particularly around the community college work, as we take a bit of a pause and ensure that we're approaching this with a, you know, as much sort of thorough deliberation as possible. You know, what's the appropriate phase-in period and phase-in plan for the universities? We're working under a sort of 4 or 5 year phase-in period, so we don't move to a new model overnight. How do you get the right balance between outcomes funding and base funding as the models are phased in? And the sort of final bullet here, and then the sub list, how can the commission effectively respond to demands placed on colleges and universities by new funding models by supporting the capacity at the institutions to take advantage of an outcomes funding system? And that, particularly for community colleges, could mean increasing the amount of sort of strategic investment that we make through the formula in core institutional capacity around IT, research, and practice to aid them in really improving outcomes and taking advantage of the new formula.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ben, I know I've said this to you in meetings before, so I kind of feel I just want to kind of say on the record is what I get. I think that I'm very supportive of outcomes based. I think as there's been a lot of discussion here, it has a lot of really great positives to it, and I just don't want us to overlook unintended consequences that might come up. Grade deflation being one of them. When the incentive is for schools to graduate more people, there is, you know, can be, you know, covert or overt pressure to pass, you know, pass kids through. We want these kids to get their certificates, you know, lower your standards, whatever. And I'm not saying that it would, but it's just one of those, it's not it, unanticipated consequences. The more we can anticipate unanticipated, you know, shifts like that, the better we can kind of be on the lookout for them. And I think you're premise of course it wouldn't go all to this and it would be a mix, but I just wanted to say that on the record.
Representative Smith Warner, Madam Chair, it's a very important point, and along with equity, which we could also talk about the potential unintended consequences there, this issue or this concern about quality is something we take really seriously, and be happy to talk about some of the ways in which, as this work moves forward, we've tried to build in some backstops to ensure that there aren't unintended consequences for quality. I think the primary point being we have to implement carefully and gradually and watch closely and continue to monitor and assess for potential unintended consequences. But there are also steps that we're taking to deal with that, as well as the equity considerations.
Ben, did you have a Senator, okay. To kind of follow up on that, coming from the K-12 background, but observing the higher ed process, it always seems like there's more checks and balances with national research institutes than what we see in K-12. And for some reason, that always gives me a feeling of confidence that we've set the bar, we're staying there. The course syllabus, when they're changed, they go through quite a process to make any changes. And so Is that a real kind of instinctive type of situation, or am I just thinking higher ed's just kind of got their act together better on looking at some of those things?
Representative Kump, it's a good question. I'm not sure I'll do it justice, but I will. There is one feature to which you're alluding that we probably don't pay enough attention to in a policy context, which is the role of the accreditation agencies for higher education. As concerned as the universities and colleges are about state policy and state funding, they are equally and sometimes even more concerned about what their accreditors, which are not public entities in the sense of being elected and having public dollars, but have the ability to very significantly impact whether an institution thrives or even exists or qualifies for federal financial aid or other sort of important considerations for an institution. And those accreditation processes do a lot to ensure quality at colleges and universities, sort of irrespective of what's happening on the policy front. So I think it is the case that there are these sort of regional and national organizations that are helping to ensure quality that even apart from anything that we're doing here.
Thank you.
So I did want to note the commission has elevated in our work the goal of developing a funding and achievement plan for reaching our 40-40-20 goals by 2025. And so we're working on this. We're not terribly far in the process, but what we hope to be able to present to you at some point in time is a sort of funding plan for getting to the 40-40-20 goals. And so I wanted to flag that project for you, indicate sort of how we're going at it, and then show you just a couple of pretty interesting pieces of data that have arisen from that work. So again, the goal ultimately would be to say, okay, if 40-40-20 is the goal, here's what this means for higher education funding over the next 10 years. So we would determine the cost of shifting educational attainment rates towards that 40-40-20 trajectory. We're starting at the outset with a focus on the pipeline, not the adult age population. That will come next, but needs to be built into the sort of final version of this plan. It's not enough simply to focus on today's second graders, the high school class of 2025. We need to look also at our adult population, but our first phase focuses on that pipeline. We're proposing and developing an interactive model that demonstrates sort of key leverage points, pathways, productivity, and the associated costs with each, and I'll show you an example of that in a moment. The model should permit the ability, permit us to estimate the total cost and apportion that cost between state, local, and students and their families on a yearly basis. So an interactive model, we can say, okay, if it's less resources paid by the state, it's more for students and their family. And we can play with that. Hopefully it will help to identify areas for strategic investment, focused investment in partnership with other groups. A bunch of assumptions. I'm not going to go through these. These are helping to drive the initial phase of the work, but this gives a sense of how we're beginning to approach it. This is data that looks different, but essentially you've seen it before. It's pipeline data. It's our current progress towards 40-40-20. These bars look like they're stacked. Actually, the green wedges are sitting in front of the black or gray wedges. But each we're trying to drive each of these wedges towards that 40% bar across the top. That would be 40% BA completion. This shows it's a little bit complicated, but it shows that for years after expected high school graduation date, what percentage of that class of 2006, high school class of 2006, had earned a bachelor's or associate's degree. You've seen that data in a different form. This is the one that I actually want to focus on, even though it may be the most complicated. I don't want to get sort of too far down the rabbit hole on this. But what this does, it will be really important, I think, ultimately, for how the state looks at investments in higher education, and we're not quite there yet, but I think it will be quite important. It looks at the eight or nine most common pathways that students take, that students took in the class of 2006 towards completion, towards it through higher education. So by pathways, some students go directly from high school to a community college and from a community college to university. Some students have gaps. Some students go directly from high school to university. This shows that each of the bars is a different type of pathway. H represents high school, X represents a gap, 2 represents a two-year college, and 4 represents a four-year university. And then the colors within each bar, the total height of the bar, the number of completions associated with that, or the number of students associated with that pathway. And then within the bar, you see what were the results of that pathway. Did it result in a bachelor's degree? Did it result in a certificate or associate's degree at a community college? So if we look at the H4, that's the third to left, these are students who went from high school directly to college. That produced that big blue tranche is a bunch of bachelor's degrees. That was a fairly productive pathway for students. There are also that gray bar are students who they had their high school diploma but did not, after at least after within 8 years, had not earned a bachelor's degree. Likewise, for H2, you can see these are students who went from high school to a two-year college. Many of them, that's the top blue, earned an associate's degree, but many more of them, after 8 years, had not earned a certificate or degree, as far as we know. And you can then see, as we move to the right-hand side, the large numbers of students, particularly if you sort of group all those, that are taking less conventional pathways, but very important ones, including from college to university, from university to college, or with gaps. And you can begin to estimate the sort of productivity of each of those. You can assign costs to each of these, and we can drive investments towards those that seem most productive. So this is a taste of the type of data that we'll be using to develop this funding plan for 40-40-20. A few key relationships have emerged, and these really reflect the data that you just looked at. Breaks, the final point here, not to single out just one, but a break between high school and college does appear to reduce the likelihood of completion. And you just, begin to get a sense of what we can do with the longitudinal data that we are beginning to have at our fingertips as we look at pathways for students and design investments associated with them. Next steps in this work is to determine and assign costs per credit hour for each of these pathways. So you've looked at student success data by pathway. We hope next to be able to look at costs associated, both state and student costs. As Representative Taylor notes, 6 years costs a lot more than 4. And that's for at least for the student, probably also for the state, a less cost-effective approach to education. Developing an interactive model and using this data to inform strategic planning and investments. I'm going to pause there, but then move to a more focused conversation on affordability, with particular attention to the opportunity grant budget request.
So we're swinging to another slide.
We are swinging
slide.
To deck number
A3.
Two. Yes.
Okay, so this can be found on today's meeting materials.
Thanks, and I've asked Bob to join me. We're going to start with a sort of overview of some ways of thinking about affordability. A lot of this will echo some of the conversation that's already occurred, and then we'll start to drill down on the budget proposal around the opportunity grant.
And we hear some students or presenters practicing their drums. So
nice, very good. So the affordability challenge in Oregon, and just to frame this, we'll come back to the budget request, but here it is. The governor's budget proposes a roughly $30 million increase in funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The co-chairs came close to that in their framework. That's in the governor's budget is POP 131. We have an accompanying bill that we'll talk about, House Bill 2407, which should be on your way to this subcommittee. It has been passed out of the House Higher Ed Committee with a referral to Ways and Means. But let's spend sort of 5 to 10 minutes on sort of how to think about affordability. And I want to take a student perspective here. And I think the reason for doing this is my goal in the sort of in this 5 or 10 minutes is to get us to think in a more nuanced way than we often do about affordability. I think for many of us, affordability has been just what's the sticker price, what's tuition. And my goal here is to try to express a more nuanced version of affordability, because it isn't just sticker price. So let's start with the student perspective. And really, I think there are three highly relevant questions to students who are looking at investing in college. One of them is, what will I spend? Another is, what will I earn or receive as a result? And finally, how does that pay off? And I'm focused here on economic returns, although there are lots of other benefits of higher education. And I think these could be simplified sort of down to cost. So that is what I'm paying. Outcome, what is the degree or certificate or other outcome from the investment? And what are the earnings associated with those? So let's take start with a sort of simplified view of this, and I would have this highly oversimplified matrix here, but let's take a few student cases and start with the student one, and let's assume that for this student the cost of the experience of the higher education was high. And by cost, I mean what they actually spent, and that's the note at the bottom. It's not tuition, but it is tuition plus living expenses, minus whatever grants or scholarships or other aid help to support that degree. So already we've moved sort of beyond tuition to cost. And let's assume that for student one, this did not result in a degree. For whatever reason, cost was high, there was no degree. Earnings, as a consequence, were probably low. And I think it would be pretty clear to us that this is not an affordable case for that student. Student two, this is a student for whom the cost is also high, but the degree that was conferred, that was earned, pays off in the form of high earnings. And understanding this is a sort of grossly oversimplified view, so you know, we have to have a real conversation about how high was the cost and how high are the earnings. But there are students for whom the cost may, in fact, be high, but so are the earnings. And we could say with some confidence that, in fact, that wasn't affordable. Notwithstanding the cost, the benefit conferred by the degree that resulted in the better earnings made it an affordable experience. Student three, and you know, your prototypical student here might be in a business degree, might be in a computer science or engineering degree, investing significantly in their higher education, paying a high cost, but also earning a lot as a result. Student three, this would be our best case, I think, a low cost experience, a degree that pays off, earnings are high relative, especially to that cost, and clearly that's an affordable and an optimal experience. And then finally, and that could be a community college student with the relatively low price of community colleges and the high earning powers that are conferred by some community college certificates and degrees. And then finally, student four, just to complete the matrix, low cost, but no degree earned. Even though it was low cost, I think it would be fair to say this is not an affordable experience. It may be low, but it was still cost. And if they didn't complete or didn't get a degree, this may in fact not be a good deal. So simplified, but tries to illustrate the way in which it's about more than
Representative
tuition.
Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ben, we've had a lot of conversations about this on higher ed over the last several years. Are you going to get into what's being done by our community colleges and universities in advising students when they come in I had a young man visit my office this week, and he said, so what advice can you give me? And I said, well, get the absolute best advice you can from your advisor at college as you're, you know, picking the university you want to go to, and make sure that the cost of the education is really going to be a benefit to you at the end. You don't want to come out with $45,000 in student loan debt and go into social work making $24,000 a year or something like that. It's just not going to pencil out. So we've had a lot of those conversations and applied pressure on our higher ed to advise students. So how are we doing?
Representative Hoffman, Madam Co-Chair, it's a great question. You will hear from the institutions, the colleges and universities themselves. I expect them to highlight some of the efforts that they're making in guidance and in counseling. And I would encourage you to press on that point with them as well. For the commission, that activity, that sort of guidance, not merely around or not just around sort of the financial decisions, but certainly very importantly, including financial decisions, is the single most important thing for us to do more of at an institutional level. And the commission has just been as clear as it could possibly be that it represents the best strategy for improving these numbers and getting better return on investment for students and the state. So the picture here, there are a lot of factors that affect affordability, not merely tuition. We have to take a full view of the costs, including tuition, but also living costs. Have to take into account financial aid, which can offset the significant amount of those costs, and in some states offset significantly more than we do in Oregon. Have to take into account completion. There can be a temptation to significantly expand access, but if it's high cost access that doesn't result in meaningful completions and meaningful in terms of their ability to confer earning power in part, then that's probably not the kind of access that we want to strive for as a state. Time to completion, coming back to Representative Taylor's point, that 6 years is, you know, 50% more expensive than four. It depends on your credit load. Some students are spreading that out, but their living costs probably are 50% more expensive if it's six rather than four. And so that has a significant relationship with affordability. The type of degree or certificate or major that a student is choosing, and their earnings after graduation all have implications for affordability. We've talked a lot about this as a major issue. Well, what's the basis for that? The basis for affordability major issue? Well, there are lots of ways to demonstrate it. We've shown some of the national context on this. But again, looking back at this high school class of 2006 data that we've spent so much time with already, this longitudinal data, this, I think, is incredibly powerful. A single piece of data that's incredibly powerful, and we have it over two slides. This is the sort of narrative. Low-income Oregonians from the high school class of 2006 were about half as likely to earn a bachelor's degree by 2012 as their peers, as their higher-income peers, even when we compare students who achieve similarly on a key measure of academic proficiency in high school. So you take two students who appear to show the same level of proficiency in high school, and if they are a higher income student, if they are free or reduced lunch ineligible in 2006, actually 2004 when they were sophomores, if they were ineligible, meaning they were higher income, they were about twice as likely to earn a college degree by 2012. So I think there's a lot that data reflects, not merely affordability issues. But the barriers that particularly lower and many middle income students face relative to college access and completion are quite significant, and this is just one way to express it. So just so you know, just to dwell on this slide for another moment, This is shows by decile students who have achieved on the left-hand side at the lowest, within the lowest 10%, lowest decile on their high school math assessment. So that's the left-hand side. The right-hand side are students at the very top level of achievement on their high school math assessment. And the bar, the height of the bar, represents what percentage of those students earned a bachelor's degree. So not surprisingly, students who did better on the high school math assessment were much more likely to earn a bachelor's degree. The real, to me, the really important relationship here is the difference between the red bars and the gray bars. Free and reduced lunch students versus non-free and reduced lunch. And that's, that to me is, so yes, we want students to, more students should be in that, it would be great if many more students were passing their high school math assessments at higher levels. That would be a really good thing for college completion. But we've got this major gap, even for those students, in college completion based on their incomes. That, I think, is a really important
point. Well, Ben, isn't it true that those that come from higher income families, their parents are probably college educated? If the parents are college educated, then it's more likely that the kid will become college educated. I mean, it's just, you tend to follow that. And that's directly related to socioeconomic status. We always praise those students who are the first one from their family to ever go to college. But their likelihood isn't near as high.
Senator Monroe, true and an important point. I think that we expect, and we should expect, college, higher education, to be available to and to be to promote sort of uplift for students coming from disadvantaged backgrounds too. And so this type of data is something that I think we need to really, really watch to ensure that these sort of distinctions, the benefits that higher income students have from families, parents more likely, who were more likely to attend, that those don't harden and calcify and make it even, and that these gaps don't worsen. Sort of coming back to the equity conversation yesterday, we should expect that higher education is our greatest engine for economic mobility, and it has been in this state and in this country. And so statistics like this, data like this, are concerning, notwithstanding, as you said, the very good reasons for it. And it's not, they're complicated and they're not simple to deal with. But
Senator Roblin.
So one of the big keys to this, obviously, is affordability. But there are a number of other key elements. Are we looking into some of those? Because we ask a lot of a low-income child to move through the stratus. If you listen to Donna Beagle in Portland and some of the other people on poverty, the culture itself means you're leaving your family behind, you're going to go do other things. It makes it more difficult to have the same support system in the future, not just then, but they're making very difficult decisions as young people with respect to their future and their relationships with parents and siblings and all of those things. Have we had any conversation about the supports for that as opposed to just the supports for financial support?
Senator Roblin, Mr. Co-Chair, sort of lost track of who has the gavel here. Mr. and Mrs. Co-Chair.
We're just playing ping pong.
We've not had enough of those conversations, quite frankly, at least at the commission level. And I think you're absolutely right. Approaching this through an affordability lens, I mean, I've put this slide in the affordability section because I think part of the reason for this is cost. But clearly, there are a lot of other factors at work here and a lot of other strategies that we and institutions need to employ to help reach these students and propel them through to college success. So I think this is an area for us to improve our understanding, improve our recommendations and techniques. I mean, we do have, and Bob's here, we do have, as you know, Aspire, which helps to reach back into high school, works with some of these students, helps to provide more than access to financial resources, but access to sort of counseling and coaching that can help to pull them through. But it's going to take, it does take a lot more than that. And again, so much of that work occurs at an institutional level, but I think we as a commission need to be aware of that and helping to support that more intentionally than we have to date.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Many of us here on this committee possibly think alike on this, and to me, this chart is the reverse of what I think students, that if you get to that 12th grade, and even if you haven't had IB or AP or any of those other classes, that if you get a student that is ready and says, I'm going to go to college, to me, many of those students are very highly motivated, and yet I remember student after student that would go to PSU or a university or Western, and they'd come back and they go, oh, Miss Comp, we thought every place was like Woodburn. And it's, and I think it is that support staff, yeah, that's either at the college, you know, at the admissions, or if they could be connected up with a certain club or wherever there's a commonality, because they're looking for that piece that's going to hold them there. But I look forward to the time that this is absolutely, possibly, potentially, at least even, if not reversed, because I think those students are very motivated. Otherwise, they wouldn't have the courage to get to college in the first place. But it's obviously hard to make those transitions. But yeah, I always like to try to figure out how we could do that. I always think that we ought to send a high school teacher from their senior year to college once a week and sit down and have a cup of coffee.
Madam Kutcher, I think that's right, and it helps to illustrate the importance of the connecting these systems, mm-hmm, the sort of K-12 and higher ed, and providing continued community for students for whom this transition can feel, in the absence of continuity of community, can feel like a pretty difficult and disruptive thing in their lives. Geography is part of that. If you're having to uproot, somebody mentioned, and go to school, for a lot of especially lower income students, that's simply for economic reasons or for sort of cultural ones. That's simply not realistic. Or success is minimized. And so having a college and a higher education opportunity that's nearby matters a lot. And there's so many factors here. And
yeah,
you've helped to point to those. I don't want to be guilty of overkill on the point around cost and affordability, but this slide illustrates the trends on tuition. That's the green bar, that's public university tuition. On the gray bar, that's community college tuition. So if you, your constituents, are wondering, well, how much has tuition actually increased? And again, we think tuition and fees are sort of a too narrow a way of looking at affordability. Nevertheless, it is what, you know, students and families are often thinking about and experiencing. This is pretty stark in terms of the significant, basically doubling of tuition and fees at colleges and universities over the last decade plus. The red line is our state need-based aid program, flat, and consumer CPI inflation is the bottom bar, just for context. So vastly outpacing. You saw how we rate as a state in terms of our funding for need-based aid. Low on a per student basis. And then finally, you know, one way beyond tuition, one metric that states and the federal government use to understand affordability is debt. And what I like about this slide, this is debt at graduation for public university students in Oregon. It's shown by racial and ethnic group, and there's probably, I think there's some interesting stories to tell there. But actually, the piece of this slide that I find most impressive or depressive, perhaps, is the fact that a student who graduates in 6 years has so much more debt than a student who graduates in four. So again, coming back to Representative Taylor's point that, you know, time to degree matters a lot here, and a student's debt at graduation is significantly higher if they complete in six versus four, or significantly lower if they complete in four. We hear a lot about in the there have been a lot in the public headlines about debt data. And so I'm not going to spend any time on these charts because there's a lot of information here. But the primary takeaway, there are two slides. One is undergraduate debt. The other is graduate school debt. The really high debt figure, the really scary, I mean, I think $25,000 of debt is scary. But the headline-inducing and sort of shock-inducing $100,000 debt figures are almost exclusively associated with graduate education, which isn't to say that that's acceptable. I think it depends a lot on the field. It depends, you know, I think we would tend to worry less about somebody coming out of medical school. However, depending on where they want to practice or what type of practice they want to be in, that $100,000 can be a real burden. But just understand that when we see that sort of shock-inducing headline around debt, it's very typically associated with graduate school debt. This is the undergraduate slide. You can see that most of it is in more in that sort of $10,000 to $40,000 range.
Representative Taylor,
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. Ben, can you, going back to the previous slide or the slide last two, just wanted to have you talk a little bit about what percentage of that debt, if you know, is associated with living costs versus tuition.
Representative Taylor, Madam Kutcher, I don't, and I don't know if it's possible to get to that level of specificity around it just because of the way that financial aid packages and lending occurs. I don't know if it's possible for us to say that particular tranches of debt are associated with tuition versus living costs. But I think it's a safe sort of presumption that a lot of the debt that students incur is associated with their living costs for higher education, that for even as high as tuition has risen in Oregon, for a full-time student, living costs represent more of the expense of higher education. Now, there are ways, you know, we could have a conversation about the estimates on living cost needs. Students living at home save a lot of money. But that there's no question that a lot of this debt is associated with living costs.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
Just building on something that Representative Huffman was talking about the doing basically its consumer protection of advising the students to perhaps, you know, live in a triple where there's an opportunity to live in a triple. And this type of, you know, work study and this type of thing, has there been an increase in efforts by the, you know, I mean, I don't know if you can speak to that, but.
Yeah, Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, I would encourage you, I think, to raise that with the institutions. Yeah. I think there has been. I mean, this question of sort of counseling and financial literacy, responsible decision-making, it's very much on the forefront of university and college administrators' minds, particularly when the debt and default rates have risen as high as they have, especially on some campuses, how to better counsel up front in order to diminish the likelihood of that is a pretty acute concern for many campus leaders.
Thank you.
I know medical students are inclined to go into specialties because the specialties pay more and they can get their debt paid off sooner, whereas what we really need are more general practitioners, especially in the rural areas.
Mr. Co-Chair, that's right. And that's why I think coming up with any sort of concise conclusion about these debt figures really does require understanding what the degree field is, and it really comes down to an individual case. There are undoubtedly cases of students with pretty high debt where a reasonable person would look at it and say, that was a worthwhile investment. It was high cost, but boy, that really paid off. On the other hand, we know there are examples of students with high debt loads where it's not paying off. It's not affordable.
And the encouraging students to do it in 4 years, we talked about that quite a bit. With dual credit opportunities increasing, and we want to see them increase even more, there's a greater likelihood of being able to complete in 4 years. I took 5 years to do my undergraduate work. I was married. I was working full-time. I paid as I went. And that was not unusual in that day and age. But there weren't any AP courses in those days either, and there weren't any dual credit opportunities. So I came out of high school with a high school diploma.
Right. Mr. Co-Chair, yes, and I expect that you heard from ODE and you will hear from OEIB about the emphasis on accelerated learning, about the schools and the districts where there are students earning associate's degrees before they've completed high school in 4 years. And that's rare, but it's not impossible. And that is a pretty significant head start on college, and means that 4-year completion is going to become much, much more likely.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Coach, or Mr. Co-Chair. So a couple points, because we're living in this right now, and we're talking about crunching every penny that we're looking at and spending in just a few months for college. The college has been very clear, very upfront, what it costs. I mean, they have a line for gas. Now, they have not factored in how far, it's an average, how far it is from our home, of course, but it's been very clear. I don't feel like any costs have been hidden from us. There's been, it's ad nauseum, and it's a lot. That said, one of the pieces of the student debt that needs to be talked about here, I think, is not just those very legitimate college costs, but student loan money can be spent in the student store.
Yeah.
And you can buy video games. You can buy lots of cool stuff. So when we're talking about incurring debt, that's important. And boy, that's being hammered in the Springer House right now, is what's it cost and how's the money spent and what's our investment, what's your investment. But let's remember, students have the latitude to spend some of that loan money any way they want. And we can't control that, and I'm not saying we should. But it's not all costs tied to education and the value.
Representative Springer, Mr. Co-Chair, I think that's a really good point. And I think you'd find some of the institutions changing the way that they notify students of their eligibility for loans in particular, because for some institutions for a long time, that when that award notice goes out or that eligibility notice goes out from the college, it's been sort of for the maximum possible award, right? And it says to a student who is very likely not financially highly literate, at least, may not be literate at all, that's like, woohoo,
it's
sign
a check
up, right? Yeah.
They see it as a check.
So I think you'll find at institutions greater attention to this and some different ways of notifying that to help students take a more prudent approach. I want to be cognizant of time and recognize that we're probably getting close to finishing. There are a few more slides in this section, and we'll pause then. We've stressed the role of the fact it's about cost, not tuition, that grants can help. Including need-based aid can help reduce the cost, that that debt is a metric that we use. And finally, time to degree matters. Again, I do want to stress the value that higher education continues to be for students who complete, even at modest debt loads. And we see in our universities, this is One of these slides, Senator Monroe, I've gotten very self-conscious about these, that doesn't start at zero. Well, this one does, but then it has that.
Got that,
you know, it jumps real fast to 54%. Uh-huh. So I'm starting to feel self-conscious about this. But nevertheless, you see a trend, an increasing trend of percentage of our public university students who complete, and that's positive. That has a big that's good for affordability. Again, one of the ways that we can improve affordability is to improve the likelihood that students complete. And then payoff, again, just to remind ourselves, yes, we have an affordability issue. Yes, we need to address it through increased need-based aid and lessening the tuition increases. But so too does higher education remain a highly positive investment for students on an aggregate basis. Doesn't deal with the individual cases, but earning powers go up significantly as a result of college completion. And so the key takeaways here, tuition is not the entire story. Financial aid matters. Outcomes and earnings matter. Affordability really needs to be a sort of interlaced strategy, and that's what we're trying to express. And tomorrow we'll talk about, and you'll hear mostly from Bob Brew about our proposals relative to Oregon's need-based aid program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Ben, earning more money is a good, positive reason for getting a college education. But there's another, maybe even more important reason, and that is you get to spend your life getting paid for something you enjoy doing. People stuck in a job that they don't enjoy because they have to earn a living, to me, they're in a sad state. Whereas if you go to college, the likelihood is that you can spend your working life doing something you really enjoy and get paid for it.
Mr. Kutcher, thank you. I always feel the risk when I have the conversation as we have about affordability, that I'll be understood as suggesting that the importance of higher education is related strictly to earnings. And that couldn't possibly be further from the truth. My own experience of higher education was so different than that, right? When I look at the value that I derive from higher education, it had a lot less to do with earnings and a lot more to do with other things. And that is true for so many Oregonians. And so yet when we're focused on affordability, we just hope that earnings will be understood as part of the way to think about whether that investment was affordable or not. That, unless you want to start up the next section, Mr. Co-Chair, I think we can stop there for the day.
Okay.
I should probably never refuse the opportunity to continue on, but I think that we'll get back on schedule tomorrow. All right. By starting at this point.
This is a good place to break. Are there questions for Mr. Cannon before we adjourn? Anything for the good of the order? Madam Co-Chair, anything for the good of the order?
I'm just fine.
Mr. Wilson?
This is just to announce that Monday will be public testimony day, and that public testimony will be in the areas of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the affordability, as well as the equity lens related subjects. And then in future days, as we go through the HEC budget, there'll be a day for community colleges, there'll be a day for public universities, part of a day for OHSU. So we're dividing this public testimony up a little bit.
And Monday, do you know what room we'll be in? Or
I'm assuming here, but we will, I'll talk to the agency and get a sense if they have any idea how many people are coming in, and we may change, and I'll announce that tomorrow.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Cannon, we will see you tomorrow, and we will continue, and we're adjourned. Adjourned.